Welcome to Interviews for Resistance. Since election night 2016, the streets of the U.S. have rung with resistance. People all over the country have woken up with the conviction that they must do something to fight inequality in all its forms. But many are wondering what it is they can do. In this series, we'll be talking with experienced organizers, troublemakers, and thinkers who have been doing the hard work of fighting for a long time. They'll be sharing their insights on what works, what doesn't, what has changed, and what is still the same. I am Sarah Jaffe, your host.
I'm Ellen Bravo. I'm co-director of Family Values at Work. We're a network of coalitions in 24 states, naming policies like paid sick days and paid family medical leave insurance.
So Donald Trump's budget, if we can call it a budget, has some provisions that they're saying look like paid leave. Can you talk about what is in those proposals and what perhaps most notably is not in them?
I've been thinking a lot about shell games, you know, how in order to win a shell game, the person has to get your eyes on one shell while they're manipulating the others.
Yeah.
And that's what this budget is. They're hoping that by naming paid leave, you won't notice that they're slashing and destroying everything from Medicaid to food stamps to child care to disability payments, et cetera. Secondly, the paid leave itself, they call it paid family leave, but of course it's paid parental leave.
Yeah.
It doesn't deliver even for parents. So the problem is it's relying on an unsustainable funding source, state unemployment insurance. They're already grossly underfunded and leave out large numbers of people. The states will get to set the eligibility and amounts of payment for your benefit. So it's only for 6 weeks. So too little time for too little money for too few people.
Yeah.
And essentially it's going to be, since it's another shell game, to say that the money will come from reducing fraud in unemployment insurance, which is very, greatly exaggerated,
right,
this problem. Essentially it will mean that states will have to cut unemployment benefits to laid off workers,
right,
in order to have money for the parental leave. And of course, they're the same people.
There'll
be someone who needs one and later the other, or their partner. And then, you know, they get to decide who qualifies. So if you're an unmarried couple, same sex couple, how are you going to certify who gets to, adoptive parents, who gets to be considered legitimate?
Right.
And then the vast majority of reasons people need leave,
right,
isn't for a new child. It's for your own health illness or for caring for a loved one. And that, of course, isn't covered.
Right.
So this is a budget that delivers only to one group, and that is the wealthiest corporations and the wealthiest individuals, and slams the rest of us, and then tries to use this as a shell to make us think there's something in it for us. But when you just look not even very deep, you see that it's unworkable, and it leaves out the essential elements of the program.
So this is supposed to be like Ivanka Trump's baby. I remember during the campaign seeing these ads with, you know, Ivanka Trump sitting on a couch talking about how her dad was going to give us all paid family leave because he cares about something, something, women, something. and, you know, so Ivanka has this book out now, which is like the Ivanka Trump version of Lean In, I guess. And it's been fascinating because, you know, there has been this strand of lean in feminism that you and I have discussed before in other places, that is kind of, you know, led from the top and does think about these policies mostly as how they can affect women at the top. And so, you know, it's been fascinating to sort of watch that be co-opted by this very right wing president. Yeah, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that, about the way that Ivanka has been mobilized on this issue and what that says in a country where, like, you know, again, 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump.
Right. One of the things that, you know, if you look at the book or the reviews the book, you realize immediately how shallow and phony it is, you know, full of platitudes and this disarmingly inappropriate quotes, like using a quote from Beloved about slavery and what it does to you internally, and are you really able to be free afterwards of the influence of having been enslaved, daring to use such a quote to talk about people being slaves to their phones and their calendars. But the other thing that is really clear is that this is a person who is clueless about how the majority of people live. I mean, Sheryl Sandberg, to her credit in Lean In, acknowledges from the start that she privileged as resources the majority of people don't, and that there's a need for massive changes in public policy for those majority of women. Mm-hmm. Ivanka is unaware of how the majority of people live. She has this, there's a great Samantha Bee clip where Ivanka is saying, well, and if your child is sick, there goes your balance, because surely you're going to stay home that day. And Samantha Bee says, and the next day and the next, because your boss, who is not your dad at the chicken processing plant, is going to fire you for having a sick kid.
Yeah.
Follow your bliss. So, you know, what I realized about Ivanka that we have to pay attention to, I don't care what she thinks in her heart. I'm not judging her as an individual. It's not important to me.
Yeah.
But I do think we have to look at her role. And her role during the campaign was to be the pretty packaging that made a predator palatable to the electorate. And now her role is not to moderate his extremism, but to camouflage it. And that's particularly dangerous.
Yeah, yeah. So you have been fighting on this front for a very, very long time. So let's talk about what a real paid family leave plan would look like, what real family policy would look like.
That's the good news. We know exactly what it looks like because we have a proposal on the table, and that proposal has been spurred by successful programs in 3 states, and 2 more have now won, and 5 more are on the horizon to win. And here's what we've learned. First of all, that we call it a AAA rating.
Yeah.
A program needs to be accessible, affordable, and adequate. And notice I say adequate, not ample. Because what we're asking for is modest, not only compared to what families need, but also to what the rest of the world literally offers.
Right.
And so what does that mean? Accessible means for all families, for all reasons to leave, and, you know, just recognizing that caregiving is a, you know, good thing, and we shouldn't punish people because they're being a good child to their parents or a good parent to their child or a good partner or following doctor's orders.
Right.
It should be affordable for families and for businesses. You know, small businesses don't want this unemployment model because it may well result in higher taxes for them, and that's hard for them. They want to provide paid leave for their workers that can't afford it on their own. Social insurance program, which is the model I'm describing, where you pool very small contributions, and there's enough money in the pool that workers who need leave can draw their wages, a good portion of their wages while they're out. So that's the next thing. That to be affordable for also means that the highest percent of wage replacement should go to those who earn the least, and that there should be job protection. This is what we've learned from the programs in place, and they're now all going back to improve them. And the new ones that are being passed, like in D.C., workers who earn up to 150% of the minimum wage will draw 90% of their wages while they're out on leave. Washington State is doing that for even a higher number of people, and so on.
Yeah.
And finally, it should be adequate time that's decent for bonding or healing. And we know from the American Academy of Pediatrics, for example, that means at least 12 weeks, but seeing 12 weeks as a basic minimum for bonding with infants. and surely for people recovering from cancer surgery, et cetera. Even a C-section, you know, the time that Trump planned is 6 weeks. You have a C-section, your doctor says you need at least 8 weeks. Babies need 12 weeks.
Yeah.
It's completely the wrong way.
Right now, because the administration is obviously not going to give us much in the way of real family policy, a lot of these struggles are going on in the states and have been going on in the states for, you know, decades. So talk about where some of the local struggles have been successful, where are some of the local struggles going on right now, and how can people get plugged into building family policies that work wherever they are?
That's so glad that you asked that. So we encourage all the people who are listening or reading this to go to familyvaluesatwork.org and just sign up, and we'll plug you in wherever there are struggles going on or help you start new ones. The good news is that there are lots of states that are involved in this, and they include states that are on the brink of winning it, like Massachusetts and Connecticut and Oregon and Washington and others. But they also include states like Montana and Wisconsin, where it's going to be a much harder struggle, but where they're building these broad and diverse coalitions, bringing together people who care about ending poverty, care about public health, care about maternal mortality and infant mortality rates, care about breastfeeding, care about child development and about seniors and so on. And, you know, we like to talk about the intended consequences of what we're winning. And one of those intended consequences is getting people to see that change is possible and that they are the agents of that change, and understanding what the what happens to us that we've been told is up to us to fix, in fact, is a systemic problem, and that together we can come up with a solution. There is, by the way, also a federal bill, the Family Act, that was inspired, as I said, by these state wins, sponsored by Senator Gillibrand and Representative DeLauro. And we're helping build support for it and making it an issue. You know, it should be, we should see the elections in 18 and 20 as a which side are you on moment, and get people to pony up. Will they support the things that working families need? Will they, are they really valuing families? Do they really care about women's equality? Do they really care about ending racial discrimination? These are the kind of policies we need, and we need to see where they stand.
So the movement for paid sick leave, paid family leave, things like this has really grown alongside the movement for higher wages, alongside like the Fight for 15. We've seen these policies sort of go hand in hand in a lot of places where they'll raise wages and then, or they'll do paid sick days and then they'll do the next thing and then they'll look for the next thing. And it's been interesting to me to watch the development of these, you know, questions and policies around time and time off. Like I've been writing about these fair scheduling acts as well that are moving forward in a lot of places. And so, you know, right now we're looking at a Trump labor relations board that is not going to be terribly friendly to workers' rights, but it's interesting to see nonetheless the way that the movement is developing its thought on certain issues. And I wonder if you want to talk about the way that thought and organizing around time and time off has been developing over the years you've been working on this.
It's a great question. You know, when we started Family Values at Work, which was in late 2003, the people who were part of fighting for good jobs did not think about time to care. The people who were fighting poverty didn't think about work. They just thought about safety net. The people who talked about work and family didn't talk about low-wage workers. They just talked about professionals and mainly women. Candidates weren't talking about these issues, and largely the women's movement wasn't either. All of those things have changed now. And so people who put out proposals for good jobs understand that it doesn't matter if it's $15 an hour if you get $0 an hour because your kid is sick. Or because you have a baby. And people who are looking for local hiring realize that you can't get a decent job and then be kicked out of it just because you're doing exactly what we tell you to do as a society in terms of being a responsible parent, et cetera. So that's really been exciting to see, and clearly there's been a lot of effort to make those connections, but there's a lot more cross-sector movement work going on. Another example of that is making sure that our definition of family is as broad as possible in both the paid sick days, because paid sick days, of course, is just a few days a year for routine illness that happens to everybody, whereas paid family and medical leave is for those longer leaves you occasionally need for welcoming a new child or for a serious personal or family illness. And people are realizing that we have to make sure that the definition of family includes all families, LGBT families and chosen families and immigrants and others who have extended families. And so that's been really great seeing those kind of partnerships develop.
And obviously the first and biggest response to the election of Trump was the Women's March. And so it's been interesting to watch the development of this resistance movement as something that is often defined very specifically as feminist. And there have been some struggles around this. Obviously, we can talk about the Democratic Party still sort of struggling with whether or not it is going to make abortion access central, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I was struck by the rise of both the Women's March as this really massive, possibly the biggest demonstration in U.S. history, and then some of the actions that have followed that. And I wonder what you think about all of this as, again, somebody who's been watching the tides of feminism shift in this country for a little while.
What was so great about the Women's March was the intentional efforts that were welcoming, I think, to the vast majority of people there to link movements and issues and to say, can we talk about women without talking about all women? And if we're talking about all women, then we have to realize that what happens to you if you are Black or Palestinian or an immigrant or a lesbian or et cetera, that matters also to your life as a female. And so that's one thing. But I think for some people, they realize a deeper way of looking at it is also that what hurts someone else, one of these groups, strengthens the hand of those who would deny women equality. And so we have to understand who we're talking about, who the opposition is, and go beyond a broad, vague sense of men to the people who really do benefit from discrimination and talk about power and talk about system change. So I think there were a lot of people for whom this was new. They just hadn't encountered it much before. And it was a lot of jubilation and rage mixed together at the march. So it's not surprising to me that so many people went back and said, I can't not continue doing this. I have to find ways to stay active and involved. And I have to think about if they do a Muslim registry, I will be the first in line to register, even though I am not a Muslim. I will not let this happen. That there are people who've never thought much about immigration who are realizing I need to be part of watched groups and others who try to do everything we can to make our city welcoming and safe and to fight efforts to use law enforcement in this punitive way. So that's been really exciting to see. And just all of our coalitions have had lots more activists and people wanting to get involved. And I think the Women's March was the spark that showed people that how much power and sense of urgency and possibility we can make happen, and it helps make sure that continues.
Yeah. Yeah, and in particular, there was, you know, around the around International Women's Day, the women's strike that called for, explicitly called for a feminism of the 99% and sort of called people to think about what the content of their feminism is in a way that, you know, it was not comfortable for a lot of people. There was some resistance to this, but it was also a sort of deeply necessary conversation, I think.
Absolutely. And, you know, you see it in the conflict about how do we deal with Trump voters.
Right.
And on the one hand, the important acknowledgement that there are people who feel unseen and that people look and feel looked down upon and that the hurt in their lives is not paid attention to. And that's important. But on the other hand, a lot of those folks were motivated by blatant racism. And if we don't name that and figure out what to do about it, we're never going to win.
Yeah.
If we say, well, forget those people, we don't care, we're just feeding fascism in this country and white supremacy, and we cannot do that.
Right.
On the other hand, we can't win over those people by ignoring issues of race. I've written this song. I'm trying to find someone to make it into a song called Who Taught You to Think That? And I feel like that's a really important question that we have to ask people. The choice isn't between ignoring race or yelling at people. The question is really getting people to think about who made me think that the reason my job got shipped overseas was because of refugees, or that the reason I can't pay my rent is because of immigrants, or you know, LGBT people, or who uses the bathroom. And the more we ask, get people to think about that and realize who benefits when they think that, and who gets off the hook, and who they should be directing that anger at, the better off we'll be.
Yeah, for sure. So how can people keep up with, you already mentioned the Family Values at Work website, but how can people keep up with some of these local campaigns, and how can they keep up with you and your work?
Well, it's easy to follow us on Facebook, at Family Values at Work on the Facebook page. But the good news is there's everybody in their city. There are groups sprouting up all over the place. There are indivisible groups. There are you know, groups that you should follow. You should follow groups that are part of Black Lives Matter. You should follow groups that are part of immigrant rights. You should follow groups that are part of the labor movement. The labor movement is under profound attack and they need support, the right to organize and collective bargaining. And there are people who are learning to run for office and wanting to get involved in voter registration and voter engagement, fighting for voter rights. What matters, I think, is finding something and going deep if you can, and bringing in people you know who feel the same way, and realize it's not just about showing up at as many demonstrations as you can. I think it's really about finding a place, a niche that feels right to you, that speaks to your life, that recognizes issues you're dealing with, but also connects to these other movements in a way that says we have to march arm in arm, but we can only do that if we have each other's back, and we can only have each other's back if we understand how these various forms of oppression wind up strengthening the people who are blocking what we need to.
Interviews for Resistance is a project of Sarah Jaffe with assistance from Laura Faillebois and support from the Nation Institute. You can find more information at necessarytrouble.org. Thanks for listening.